Welcome to The Running Public with Bracken Crocker and Kirk DeWint.
Whether you are a brand new runner or you already have a great mustache,
we're here to help you increase your running knowledge and present it at a practical level. This is The Running Public. When you're ready to take your training or racing to the next level, go to therunningpublic.com. We have both monthly subscription training plans, $19.99 a month, and Bracken and I both offer one-on-one customized coaching. Again, go to therunningpublic.com and check out our offerings.
All right, here we are, just Kirk and I today. Well, not really. Kirk and I and an invisible third partner.
Yes, yes, I'm very excited about this. Hello, everybody. And welcome our guest today, Mrs. or Mr. AI.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's going to get real techy today. However, before we do, I need to make a bit of an announcement, a PSA. What, about a month ago now, Kirk? Month and a half, I did a solo episode when you had COVID, and I talked about there are two types of athletes. Talk about people who get it done, people who don't. Basically saying just like, we're tired of hearing your excuses. You're not special. You're not unique. Get it done, and then you're unique and special.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people that episode resonated with, but in the past 2 weeks now, I'm probably approaching double digits of people reaching out, having digested it and sat on it for a while, and then a well-thought-out response to it. If they don't agree with me, or they were offended by it, or they didn't like it, and here's why. Like, when we first put one out, we get the gut reactions. Someone just puts their thumbs to work and sends something mean or something awesome. But when the episode is like a month old and you start getting messages, you know people have ruminated about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let it ruminate. Is that more accurate?
Do you know what a ruminant is?
A ruminant?
Yeah.
I assume it's like sediment, something that is settled to the bottom of a container.
That is not correct.
Oh, not correct. Learn me then, Kirk.
A ruminant is a type of animal in which they take a long time to digest their grazers. They regurgitate like a cow in their cud. Ruminants typically have multiple stomachs, and it sits in there and ruminates before it's fully digested, not like the digestive tract of a human. A ruminant.
Well, I was extremely far off.
And now I don't know how accurate I am, and I feel like I should ask AI what a ruminant is.
Let's kick off with that as soon as I'm done saying what I need to say.
Okay.
We'll test out ChatGPT with that question.
I already asked.
Oh, good.
Yep.
Say it.
A ruminant is a type of mammal characterized by its unique digestive system, which allows it to efficiently break down a complex...
Yeah, you're smarter than me. Get out of
here. Yeah, right. That's just because I like deer. Okay, continue.
You didn't even type that in. You're just repeating your question in a more formal manner.
No, I'm not. Sorry, distracted.
It's okay. So here they have all been very valid replies. And I think one of the major disconnects, and maybe it wasn't a disconnect, maybe they already took this into their ruminator, ruminated upon it, and then came out with their reply, is that what I was talking about was low-level issues, type of issues that are very easy to overcome. I wasn't talking about death. I wasn't talking about poverty. I wasn't talking about racism, social injustice. There are things in life that are true obstacles that deserve sympathy and help from everyone around you, if possible. The community all would need to be there for you to have any chance at overcoming it. This is not what that episode was about. When I was being very harsh and saying you're not special, no one cares, I wasn't saying that your race has been downtrodden upon and we don't care, or you have no money to your name, but go to college anyway. That's not the thing I'm talking about. You've had everyone in your family perish or get sick in the last 6 months and your training suffered. No, I'm talking about you're having trouble getting out of bed to get the workout done because you're lacking motivation. You're sore. You're tired. You have the sniffles. You're stressed. You're emotionally a little bit below level right now, that kind of thing. Surface level issues, not deep down to the core, roots in the ground type issues. We have empathy, I'd like to believe. We have sympathy, mm-hmm. And there are times where it is well earned and just and needed. This episode was only about surface level issues that everyone wants to be successful and is successful gets over along the way. Not the type of deep-seated social, economical, racial, financial issues that can truly destroy people. So that being said, everything else that you reply to me is probably valid, and I've taken it to heart, and I'm just wrong sometimes. But in this case, make sure that you realize I was talking about surface-level issues.
Mm. Maybe one layer below surface. We all have those things, too. But the rooted issues, the ones that really get in there. Yeah. Too bad you didn't think about saying this before you went on your speech. You got ahead of it, right?
And
Yeah. Foresight is tough to come by, but I could see how that would, in unique circumstances, upset some people.
And sometimes I justify things to people in my reply. Sometimes I just say, hey, you know what? You're right. Sorry about that. But my one common reply out to this, just to let you know where I'm coming from, is that prior to this, keep in mind, I was a special needs teacher, a special educator, and I had a cross-categorical license to work with all types of special needs, any sort of diagnosable disorder I could work with. But my main emphasis was cognitive disabilities. So we're talking Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, things that are really, really destructive and the person in no way, shape, or form asked for or deserved and needs an incredible amount of sympathy, empathy, and community support to get over. So like I come from a place of my entire world was based around not insurmountable, but immovable obstacles. They have to be accounted for on a daily basis. So I truly do believe I'm an empathetic person. Those weren't the type of issues I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's probably why I feel so haughty on this, is because I spent years watching individuals with Down syndrome and autism and cerebral palsy overcome obstacles that were placed in front of them. And I always, now that's my lens. I look at it and say, listen, if she did it, we can get out of bed and get our running.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell you what, that episode is the episode that keeps on giving in hindsight, which means it was impactful, right? Because we've referred to it many a times, even had a past guest 2 weeks ago on as a follow-up to that. So I would say you still knocked it out of the park, but like there's a few that rooted for the other team.
I think I bounced it off the wall.
Okay. Maybe you bounced, you rid the foul line just on the inside, maybe?
Yeah, one hop.
Well, that's good of you to say. I guess I haven't received anything on it because I wasn't there. So that burden was placed on your shoulders, apparently. So, okay. Well, with that out of the way, and now that we all know what a ruminant is, see you guys later. The ironic thing about today's episode is this is what we're going to do today is we are going to type in a question from our listener submitted questions. We'll paraphrase as necessary so ChatGPT can understand what we're asking, hopefully. And we're going to see what we think of the answer. And we're going to read it and dissect it and tell you our opinions on it. So you're going to get a twofer. You're going to get an AI answer and then our answer and our opinion of AI's answer. And the ironic thing about this, and I know you smirked, is I just had to create a ChatGPT account before we started. I've never used AI. In fact, it was my idea to do this, and then they said, Bracken, I don't know how to do AI. I don't know what I'm doing.
The phrase is such an old person phrase. I don't know how to do AI.
And I said that way on purpose. I don't know how to use AI. So here we are. So you're going to experience this along with me for the first time. And the first time, folks, is always the most memorable. We all know that. So here we are.
And I'm going to be a good guide for your first time, seeing as this is not my first time. But
I want to be in the hands of somebody experienced, for my first time.
So I do use ChatGPT. I had an account already, which is a huge step up on Kirk. And I think it's kind of phenomenal. However, what we haven't done is preview the responses to any of these questions. And so at the end of this, we may be exposed for being totally replaceable. Hopefully we're not. But
I sure hope not.
Should we kick her off? There's no way that we know less about this question. There are some questions we might be obsolete on. I have to assume this is a softball we're tossing up here for ourselves.
All right. Well, as you say it, I will either, do you want to read it and then I will summate and type, or should I type as you go? You're going to summate it as
I'm going to summate it into a palatable ChatGPT format here.
Lovely. All right.
How should we balance training time for OCR? Okay. Should we be spending more time strength training or running? and what is the maximal balance for performance?
That's your summation?
Yeah.
I'm summating your summation.
Yeah. Okay, maybe it wasn't a summation as much as it was clarifying it.
And I fully typed out obstacle course racing because I don't expect him and or her and or it to know what OCR means. All right, let's see what she says. I feel like a knob. Of course. She, can we say she, by the way?
I want to call it it. I don't want to assign any human characteristics to this. Otherwise, it makes me nervous.
Okay. Of course, it put OCR in parentheses in the answer.
Oh.
Okay. So the question I asked specifically was, how should we balance training time for obstacle course racing? Should we spend more time strength training or running? I kept it simple. Is that fair for starters?
Yes.
Balancing training time for obstacle course racing, OCR in parentheses, I have no faith apparently, involves a combination of strength training, running, and specific skill work. The ideal balance can vary depending on individual fitness levels, goals, and the specific demand of the OCR event. Here are some general guidelines. Talks about base building for running and endurance, and then terrain-specific training. Mimic the terrain of the OCR course. If the course involves hills, trails, or uneven surfaces, incorporate those. Strength training says full body strength and functional strength and core strength. Skill work, so it breaks it down by running, strength training, skill work, and then it goes into flexibility, mobility, rest recovery, and race simulations. Suggests periodically simulating race conditions during training to practice transitions. Now, I'll finish. You can tell me your thoughts. The balance between strength training and running will depend on your current fitness level and goals. Beginners may initially focus on building a solid running base, while those with a strong running background might prioritize strength and skill work. Regularly reassessing your programs and adjust your training plan accordingly. Consulting with a fitness professional or coach experienced in OCR training can also provide personalized guidance.
That's a really good reply. Dang. However, it's all very theoretical. It's not too far different than what we would say, but now I want action. How many times per week minimum must I lift and run to perform well in OCR?
Great. Do you want me to type that in?
I do. All right. I want numbers.
How many times per week should I run and strength train for OCR?
At a minimum. Because I appreciate that it can do general advice, but can it get specific enough to replace us? Because we have thoughts on that.
I got to type around my microphone here.
So. Yeah. I'll be removing a lot of dead air out of this episode, and that's okay. Let's see. AI. Yeah, I can probably do that.
Let's see AI do that. Yeah, let's see. Okay, well, it's giving me very similar results here. Longer answer, actually, than the previous. Let's see here. And it starts with the basic. The frequency of running and strength training for OCR can vary based on individual fitness levels, goals, and the specific requirements of the race. However, here's a general guideline for a minimum weekly training frequency. Mm-hmm. Okay, running. Base building. Aim for at least 3 to 4 running sessions per week. This can include a mix of long, slow distance runs, interval training, and hill sprints. And then it says terrain specific training, if possible, get on specific terrain. Strength training, full body strength, 2 to 3 sessions per week, focused on compound movements like squat, deadlifts, lunges, pull-ups to develop strength. I'm summating here. Skill work, obstacle specific training, da da da. Okay, it's important to listen to your body and avoid overtraining. If you're new to OCR training or have specific health considerations, it's advised to start with lower frequencies and gradually increase. Da 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 da. And then it says individual, and then it says consult with a fitness professional or OCR coach for personalized guidance again.
That's pretty darn close. We would say 3 and 2 is our bare minimum. And so then we would emphasize that that's not enough days of training per week for performance. And so you would have to add in non-impact cardio on the other days with purpose to build volume. But that's 75% of what our answer would be, at least 66% of what our answer would be.
66. It's like if you ask the question, what are the important components of a book? And somebody would say, well, it has a cover, and it has a front cover and a back cover, and it has a bunch of pages in the middle, and that is a book. Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. That is a book. I understand now. Well, that's sort of the version it's telling us. It's giving us a little more here's the book, and here are the chapters, mm-hmm. but we don't know the content, right?
Yeah.
So I think the bones of it are pretty spot on. I mean,
it said nothing incorrect.
It did not, but it doesn't tell you the contents on the pages themselves.
So we know that this is pulling from all sources in the history of the internet. Do you wonder as it's talking, how much of this has it pulled from us? Or is that way too arrogant to ask?
I don't think it's arrogant.
Trick question. We've never had anything that was too arrogant to ask.
This podcast is fueled by narcissism, folks. Times two. Just kidding. That's a joke. I'm
not narcissistic, but I think you might be.
Oh, yeah? I can't imagine that it's pulled from what if we had written content. Does it only pull from written content? Can AI pull from audio content?
Well, there's transcripts of this, of these episodes that exist somewhere. I don't know. Anyway, we can move on. That was a pretty darn good answer. It just lacked the final, like, tied together for me.
Yeah. And as a refresher, the original question, was really, how should we balance training for obstacle course racing? Should we spend more time strength training or running? It didn't answer the question directly. It gave us more than just answering the question directly, more like letting us think and applying to ourselves. But
yeah,
I would say it did pretty well.
Do you know what it reminds me of a little bit?
Huh?
When you click on, let's say, buffalo chicken dip recipes, and it gives you one, and they think that what you first want is a 7-paragraph intro about what buffalo chicken dip is, why theirs is good, where they first learned about it, and how they've tweaked it over the years, and how their guests like it, and then at the very bottom the recipes there. This is what that felt like. Like, it's just way, or like when you're on T Nation or something like that, and you're like, give us your best tricep workout. And they're like, triceps were first identified.
Called tri because it has three muscles in it. And it's very important to work.
Hitting all three muscle heads are important for maximum growth. Like, give me the workout. And then if I want more, let's dive into it. ChatGPT is kind of doing that, where they're giving you all the and information surrounding it. Mm-hmm. But the most specific piece is either missing or last.
Are you feeling threatened right now?
A bit,
you feel like your job is in jeopardy? Yeah. Very insecure.
I'm sweating like crazy. I'm like the airplane pilot.
Do you feel useless right now?
Almost. So this next question will be. This actually isn't the next question. I read the next question and we'll use that as the next question.
Okay.
But first I want to ask a question that we specifically answered previously in a podcast as a test question.
Okay.
How many hours of cardio per week do you need to do to consider yourself training at an elite level? Because if you remember, we gave three levels, basically beginner, intermediate, and advanced levels, 5 to 7, 7 to 9, 10 to 12.
All right. And just to make sure I got this right, how many hours of cardio per week do you need to do in order to consider yourself training at an elite level?
Yes. Which we would say 10 to 12 hours plus.
All right. Okay, so I think what ChatGPT, oh my gosh, okay, I think what ChatGPT does is it gives you, like, to start, it's giving you like a, not an overview, but like a covering their butt, like the amount of cardio aerobic training required to each can vary widely depending on the specific sport. I didn't specify. Okay, factors to take into consideration are intensity of training. Da da da. Okay. Here's the first answer. For some endurance sports like long distance running, cycling, or triathlon, elite athletes may train upwards of 15 to 25 hours or more per week.
Which is true. They started us with the high end.
Yeah. It says 15 to 25 hours per week. So we are all our novices, I think.
Excellent. All right. Moving on.
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
It's right. They do train up to 15 to 25 hours per week, but we said, what do you need to do to be considered? We're talking shallow end of the pool. They went right to the, guess how deep this pool is.
What if we asked, what is the least amount of time I need to run to complete a marathon or in training or something?
Try it.
Or would that be not helpful?
I don't think it'd be helpful because you can complete a marathon with no running.
Okay. Well, let's see if ChatGPT agrees. What is the least amount of run training needed to complete a marathon? What's your best guess?
3 hours is what they'll say. But I'm going to say zero.
It gets the back. It's a significant endurance achievement. Oh God, it's going right back to the beginning. Begin with a walk run strategy. This is worthless. Okay.
All right. Ready for one?
Yep.
So here's the actual question. We were talking about how you prefer 3-hour long runs prepping even for ultras, and I like to go all the way up to 4 because it was useful to find out what happens between 3.5 and 4. I think something special happens there. So the question was, does this apply only when it's done in a straight shot, or is it equally beneficial to do 2 hours and then 1 hour, or 3 and 1, or 2 and 2? Mm. If so, what's the time window that they have to be apart?
I like that question. How do I summate that?
Let's say, are 2 2-hour long runs as effective as a 4-hour long run when training for an ultra marathon? And while Kirk's doing this, what I'd like you to start seeing, which I'm sure you are, is that ChatGPT or any AI source is as effective as the questions are pointed. You have to start with a good question and follow up with another good question to get to where you need to go, and which is why it's hard to rely on it with no knowledge base.
So I'm just going to say, I'm going to skip all this now, but basically every time I'm asking ChatGPT, it's giving me a preface like, it depends on what the da-da-da is. And then at the end, it's always saying it's advised to work with a coach or experienced ultra runner to tailor a training plan. So I'm going to leave all that out because it gives me that every time.
Yeah. And we do a version of that in Q&As. We'll say, you know what? It really depends on the athlete, but they just take longer to do it. And they cover all their bases.
So first of all, I'm very impressed with it. I did not expect it to understand, subsurface type questions. So 2 2-hour long runs. The question is 2 2-hour long runs as beneficial as a single 4-hour long run? The benefits of 2 2-hour long runs: allows for higher intensity during each run, which may help improve speed and aerobic capacity. It's easier to fit into a weekly schedule for those with time constraints. The considerations: may not fully simulate the physical and mental challenges of running for an extended period, and less time spent on feet compared to longer single runs. Do you see any poking holes in that yet?
Not a single hole.
Okay, 1 4-hour long run. Benefits: stimulates the time on feet and fatigue experienced during an ultra marathon. Helps build mental toughness for prolonged efforts. Considerations: requires a significant time commitment, higher risk of overtraining or injury if not approached with proper preparation and recovery. And then it suggests to combine both approaches.
Does that sound runners familiar? Let's go every other week or every third.
Runners often incorporate a combination of longer individual runs and back-to-back long runs in their training plans to balance intensity and time on feet. This approach allows for the benefits of both longer individual efforts and cumulative fatigue from consecutive days of running. And I'll stop there, but not too bad. What's your response to all that?
I agree completely. It said nothing wrong again, and it covered, I would say this time, like 90% of what I'd want to talk about.
Know what I'm the problem I'm finding with these answers? Hmm. ChatGPT has no opinions. Has no opinions at all.
Right.
It just gives me the facts and that almost devalues them in my eyes a little bit because there's no experience behind it. So I'm reading this and saying like, yeah, but like, what is my experience? Mm-hmm. And I think it's a fantastic place to start with all these questions, but we're getting facts, what it believes to be facts.
Yeah. It gives you all the knowledge and then it lacks the personal touch, flourish, finish. Like I would say one of the most beneficial parts of the last 45 minutes it touched upon of a 4-hour long run is the actual wear and tear, time on feet and fatigue, but it didn't touch upon, it allows you to get more acquainted with and intimately knowledgeable with your fueling strategy and how your gear, clothes, shoes, socks, chafing, how that all interacts on race day as things settle and it's not fun and you're not bouncy anymore. Where, like, does your neck get sore from your pec? Does it torque in a weird spot? Yeah, 2 hours of your strap rubbing doesn't do much, but by 4, you're noticing it and you can extrapolate what 12 would be like. So it's just missing that final flourish.
So what's your opinion? Is it the same to go out for 2 2-hour long runs? Are you going to end up with the same result on race day? Let's say it's 100K. Let's go out to 100K. Is 2 2-hour long runs in the same day even, or back to back, going to get you as successful on race day as a single 4-hour long run for your longest effort of the month or block or whatever? What do you think?
No, I don't believe so.
I don't either.
Here's what I believe. 2 2-hour long runs are better for you systemically. You will build, I think if you could quantify all of your internal workings, red blood cell count, mitochondria, size and density, oxygen transport, all those things, it would all be better with more frequent, slightly shorter runs. because you're getting the vast majority of the benefit in the first 60 to 90 minutes anyway, and production of all that kind of tails off after a bit. So you'd be getting that part more often with way less fatigue and recovery afterwards. It would be like doing it in a lab. 4 hours important for your head, for your mind, or planning. So without the 4 hour, you'd build this perfect creature and you're not sure if it's going to hold up or do well or adapt. And without a bunch of twos, you're going to be highly adaptable and very cerebral, and you're not quite sure if your engine's going to be built up as high as it's supposed to be. So I'm saying you're not going to come out with the same structure, function, and ability to handle variations on race day with the two different approaches. Like ChatGPT said, combining the two is the way to go.
A 2 hour long run every single weekend, or a 4 hour long run one weekend and an hour long run the next, back and forth. Which
If I'm a low intensity athlete, I'm taking the 4 and 1. If I'm an athlete who does quality, I'm doing twos all day. But I think what the original question asked is 2 and 2 on the same day or 4 straight.
Sure.
And I stick to that same answer for all that, that 2 and 2 still will not replicate 4, but it'll be closer than just 2 every weekend would.
Yeah. The 4 for me, which I've done a handful of times, but not as frequently as I think you have. They're so damaging to me, especially that last hour, hour and a half. Like once I get to about 2.5, 2:45, something changes in my body, like metabolically, structurally, I don't know what it is. And then I start to be like, oh, this, even on a good day, this is not fun anymore. Mm-hmm. Like no matter how good it went prior, like my hips hurt. I dread the downhills, you know, things like that. Suddenly my feet are not comfortable for whatever reason, no matter what shoe I wear. But because of that, I think I need that. If I'm really going to go long, my body needs to be ready for that feeling, so it's not new on race day. And I think it's damaging, but it's also damage forces adaptation. And that is notably more damaging to me than, let's say, a 2 hour, or even if I went back to back 2 hours. And I believe that when it comes to the back half of an ultra, for me, that would really make a big difference. Yes, the recovery is longer from a 4 hour effort. Yes, you may be running slow and grumpy the last hour of your 4 hour long run, but like you're going to be running slow and grumpy on race day too, and you might as well get comfortable with it. And yep. So for me, I would pick the 4 in 1 chunk every time, but that's a personal thing. Very well, you could perform better off 2 and 2 if you're just a slog of a runner and you want to uptick your tempo, and that might yield a faster overall result.
Yeah.
Who knows? You could argue both.
And I do want to clarify, I've probably only done 4 hours in training 3 times in my life. I've done 3.5 hours probably 10 times in my life.
But what's the longest you've gone in a single training run?
4 or 4:0 or something like that. 4.
4. I accidentally went 5 in a ditty once.
Got lost?
It was a Palm Springs, San Jacinto snowstorm situation. I actually got pretty dire, had to turn around, that whole deal. But it ended up being like, 5 and change and terrifying at times. But, and then very few. I've done 3.5 a number of times, and then only 4 in races, or like I go run for my birthday and it ends up being only 4 hours, you know?
Yeah, I've done 3 to 3.5 probably 20 or 30 times, but 4 only 3 times, I think. It's just when I haven't done much ultra racing recently, I have to do one of those to remind myself. Sometimes it's just training's going too well and I'm starting to get too excited for the race. And when it gets bad on race day, it'll be too much of a surprise. Again, you need to slap yourself down once or twice throughout your training block so that you don't go in expecting it to be just rainbows and butterflies the whole time.
Yeah, for me, that's important. Same thing as if you run your first OCR race after only in quotes, pure running, and suddenly you're like, it's not hard. I go on monkey bars and I run. Like, that can't be that hard. And then you go feel it and you're like, what on earth? Why am I suddenly a degraded version of myself and this is terrible? You just got to feel it. For me, feeling it's important. That's why the long run. I just got this question from an athlete. I used to coach Sean White. He said, it seems like you guys are moving away from believing in the 3 hour long run. Do you feel like 2 hours is enough? My answer was like, no, of course not, especially if you're racing 90 minutes at for sure 2 hours or longer. Like, no, like the long run of 3 hours is absolutely vital with bouts of more. So, no, I think maybe we give the impression because our interviewees have shared opinions about maybe going shorter, and that certainly isn't our philosophy for ultras.
Yeah, I think the more often you go past 3 hours, the less you need to do it. But the more you need to hit 90 minutes to 2 hours as frequently as possible. And keep in mind, a lot of these people we interview are racing five-ish ultras a year. That means they're doing more four-hour runs than I am without ever doing a training run, because they're getting that stimulus. And the more you've done it, the less you need it. The more you just got to keep pushing your engine up.
I didn't see ChatGPT riffing like this, Bracken.
Nope, we're riffing. So to answer the actual first question, or the second part of the first question, if you're doing 3 + 1 in a day, 3 hours in the morning, 1 at night, 1 in the morning, 3 at night, 2 and 2, how much time should you have in between the runs? What's the minimum and maximum to get that benefit of 4 hours straight? How do you balance that?
I like that question. I don't know. That's going to be an opinion-based question. For me, I tell my athletes 4 hours. I tell them, go get some food in you, get off your feet for a little bit, and get back out. I just say four, anywhere like four-ish would be great. I start there. What do you do?
I mean, the minimum is however long you need to sit at your car before you're ready to move again.
Yeah. The maximum, is that even considered split runs at that point?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. But like, there's a point where you get in a run where you're just ready to be done. But if you stopped and ate a sandwich and drank something, maybe 20 minutes later, you're ready to go. And now it's just a long aid station, which is very ultra specific, but it's not a split run, but it's like an interval session, 2 by 2 hours with 20 minute recovery. Like that's still the same session. But the longest, I think you don't get more than, I was going to say 8 or 9 hours, but if you did it at 6 a.m. and 6 p.m., it's still the same day and you worked all day. I would say you don't sleep. If you sleep, it's not a double session.
So if somebody were to like get done with their run, go home, eat a big breakfast, let's say they had just a snack and then they took a nap for an hour and then got back up, put their shoes on and went again, would you be like, that negates the point?
No, I think
the best way to do it.
Maybe it's an hour or 90 minutes is like my cap. 20 minute nap, great. But certainly overnight, even night to morning. And I've done this before. I've done a big workout at night, slept all night, got up in the morning, and it's just not the same as AM to PM. It's not the same. I did a run prepping for Tahoe Ultra 1 year where I did 18 in the late afternoon on Saturday, and then Sunday morning did 17. And I was compromised for that 17, but I was fatigue compromised. The pounding wasn't waiting in my legs as much. Like I had rested enough. I had slept enough that it didn't feel like my feet were swollen or my knees were creaky. I was just a little tired from the day before. I had less pop in me, but it was not the same as that feeling where your legs are still at post run. I wasn't post run anymore. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense.
Okay.
Yeah. I think, and then the other thing I would add, a personal preference is, if you're going to split it, let's say 2 and 2, that morning session, I would encourage you to maybe even make that a quality type long run. Mm-hmm. And you can sort of overcompensate for the lack of steady time on feet by accumulating more fatigue in that first session. Like, hey, I'm going to go rip today, or I'm going to do threshold intervals within that 2 hour long run. And now I'm just tired. Like when I go to hit it after work, like let's say you work at 8 a.m. and you can't get 4 hours in the morning and you do split it up, like you mentioned, you rip in the morning, work a full day, and then you go get a fatigued long run 2 hours after work. Like, could you say that was more effective? Like, I don't know. Maybe. Yeah. But I think you can only start to ask that question and debate it if the morning session induces real fatigue. And I think that includes a quality or up-tempo portion. Then we're really talking, if you ask me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Good work.
More questions?
Yeah.
Way to go.
Okay. So here's one that this is opinion based. Now we could give a scientific answer on this question, but the science for this is studied on sample groups that are just generally not who's listening. When you look at who the control group or who the test group was for scientific studies, rarely do you think, hey, that's me. And so as a result, it's always going to be a little different for you if it's not a massive sample size, which running based studies are usually like 8 to 20 athletes. And they're usually like 20 to 25 years old because they use a lot of university students for this. So anyways, I'm going to steer away from science-based answer on this next one and go solely anecdotally and experience-based. We cool with that?
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
How many weeks can I complete 2 VO2 max workouts in a row until I start to burn out?
How many weeks can I complete two VO2 max workouts in a row before I experience burnout? Mm-hmm. Am I with you?
Yeah. For how many weeks, it should say, I suppose.
And VO, the O is actually a zero. I don't want to confuse. Wait, is it?
No, it's a O.
So it's actually, oh yeah. I don't want to confuse. There we go. I don't
want to confuse. Uppercase. That's the tricky part.
Okay, it got it. And it's curating, so.
Well, we could have answered faster. Suck it, AI.
Yeah, you're worth this.
But we would have taken 25 minutes to answer it.
Right. So it's very interesting because every time I type these things and it gives me about the same duration of an answer, right? Like the scroll on the computer screen is roughly the same length. So it must have some sort of, I don't know, like word profile it likes to stick to, like count. Okay. The frequency at which you can perform high-intensity workouts like VO2 max sessions without experiencing burnout can vary significantly among individuals. Okay, it gave us its preface. Factors, da-da-da. It just gives us all that crap. VO2 max workouts are demanding, and they push your cardiovascular system to its limits. Overtraining or burnout can occur if you don't allow sufficient time for recovery between intense sessions. Here are some general considerations. Listen to your body. Training load. It has a descriptor below each of these, but yeah. I'm not going to read them. Variability, recovery strategies, and periodization. Oh, ChatGPT using the trendy word periodization. And then it says, as a general guideline, doing two VO2 max workouts in a row every week may be sustainable for some individuals, but it's essential to monitor your body's response. Consider consulting with a coach or fitness professional. You get the gist. So that's what it says. It doesn't give us an answer.
Okay. What's your answer?
I got how many weeks?
You say we're doing two full workouts per week in this. I don't care what the rest of your week looks like. They talked about frequency.
Yeah.
To me, that's if you hit two in a week.
Okay. I am going to say 3 weeks before a notable down week or deload from that sort of stimulus is needed. Otherwise, you may actually burn out sooner than you think. I'm going 3 weeks. Not very long.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, I generally say 3 to 5. I want three. I really can't go past five. But my caveat to this is that my intervals are 800 meters or longer for at least half the workouts. Like if I'm doing 800s, thousands, miles, it's like 3 to 4 weeks. Five, I could probably push to. However, if we look back to college training, when we're running faster than VO2 max, but we're doing a lot of 200s and 400s and 300s, we could go 6 to 8 weeks with racing, but we were on fumes by the end, but we improved for a while. So the shorter intervals you can push to, I would say 8 weeks, but that's just a long time. And I think part of the reason we could do it is we had a team around us. They shared the load of the workouts, which doesn't sound like much, but it is huge. And you're just, you can accomplish more with a herd of athletes around you than just going out by yourself. When I missed workouts, I don't know if you ever had to do this in college. Let's say we were running 12 by 200 at 800 meter faster race pace with 200 meter jog recovery. I would be, I'd probably be 25% worse in terms of reps I got done or overall pace when I was solo than when I was with a team.
Mm-hmm. I experienced that. Yeah. We'd have it over Christmas break. Our interim break coach would assign like 600 meter repeats. It was always like, that's my least favorite distance because you got to basically run as fast as a 400, but hold it longer. And man, I bombed that workout almost every time. I was just like not happy and it hurt more than it should have. And it was like by myself on the track. It was brutal.
So just like the individual workout goes, let's say 20-ish percent. I think you get an extra 20% to 25 of duration that you can extend the number of weeks for before you burn out as well.
Yeah. I will say there's never a period of time in my adult endurance training career in which I laid eggs harder than I did in college when it happened, though, because we never took down, we didn't really take hard down cycles. We would do, as a 1500 meter runner, our quality session was Monday, generally slower than race pace, but extended. And as we were still hitting VO2 max type heart rate, then we'd do something either at race pace or faster over speed training on Wednesday. So that was Monday and Wednesday. And then we raced on Saturday. Yep. And sometimes those are back-to-back meets like a conference where you race Friday and Saturday or whatever. So really, I mean, if you're not hitting VO2 max in a 1500, I don't know what you're doing out there, right? So it's like that's three bouts a week and two of them are bigger training sessions. And eventually I'd get to a race and I'd be a 4 12 miler at the time, and I'd go run 422 and 424. Like, I have just an egg. Like, I don't know what happened, but I felt awful. And so obviously there was a limit in there, and then I would reset and skip the next quality session with the team. Coach would say, okay, take it down. And it worked every time. He'd let me deload, but only after the egg was laid. And he did that with us all the time, right?
Yeah.
Like, that would happen. That workout sucked. I'm pulling you. You're going to take the next one, chill, and we'll get you back in. That was our way of deloading, but we had to prove like we were worthless in a workout first or a race. Anyways, that's, I think, 3 weeks. I'm going to stick with 3 weeks.
Good.
For me.
I like that. Yeah, if I got midway through a season and someone said, hey, there's a local 5K or mile, something around there, in blank amount of weeks from now, are you going to be ready? If I heard three, I'd say, yes, I'll be ready. If I heard four, I'd think definitely. And if I heard five or six, I'd think I'll be ready, but I'm not going to quite start yet.
Or you'll start with one VO2 max session and one threshold session.
And that's how you milk it, right?
Uh-huh.
Charlie St. Lawrence, he's running 400s on the track fast. He's approaching VO2 max in a lot of those workouts by the end. He does that almost year round, but he's doing one 400 session a week. That second session is the thing that changes the game. Some might even call it a game changer, Kirk.
Hey, you know, I find you talk about, like, we haven't talked about it much recently, but like nervous system fatigue, you do heavy back squats and heavy deadlifts. And then suddenly, like, you do big max efforts throughout the week and they go well. And then you go for your quality long run on Saturday and you like have nothing. You're like, I am drawing from nothing. Like, my tank is empty and I don't know why. And you can't even, if my legs aren't sore, this, like, I just have nothing today.
Mm-hmm.
Like, chalk that up as like systemic or metabolic or nervous system fatigue. I feel like the VO2 max work like that is almost, that's where it hits harder. Like, yeah, your calves get a little ripped up. Yeah, your hamstrings are generating more power. Mm-hmm. But like sometimes, like if you do too much, you'll just go and just be flat for no reason. Be like, I slept well, I ate well, I'm caffeinated, and I go to start and I'm like, I've got nothing. Yeah. That's how I feel like over VO2 max training. You can't even explain it. You're like, my body just doesn't work today. You know what I'm saying?
100%. Efforts that you have to really go to the well. And when I say that, I mean, you have to dig deep and fight in the second half of the effort. I don't care if it's a workout or a race. They change how destructive they are to you compared to equivalent duration or intensity workouts. Like, you can do a workout that's fairly intense, but you don't have to reach quite as deep, but you do more total reps and the overall like intensity score, so to speak, would be the same. And it doesn't destroy you the same way. Like, you can go on a 4 hour mountain run and get the same amount of vert and the same amount of distance versus going as hard as you can the last 30 minutes of that run. And the recovery demands are so drastically different. Even in a race like a 5K, falling off the back of the pack versus kicking home, accelerating the final 800 and emptying the tank the final 100, it's like a 4 day difference in my recovery. Just in the last 800 meters of a 5K race, those last 800 meters determine, can I do a workout in 2 days? Or is it going to be like 5 or 6 days before I want to do anything hard again?
And that's the one qualm, caveat, discrepancy I have with Strava's relative effort score.
Yep.
Is when I start trying to peak or over speed train or VO2 max training, I leave, like, I was doing mile repeats at goal 5K pace. That doesn't sound like much, but that was a big workout for me with a quarter mile jog recovery. Like, that is a lot of work trying to run whatever it was, 449 for four of them. And anyways, but my suffer score in quotes was like nothing compared to, like, if I went out and did threshold intervals that day and spent five times the amount of quality time on feet, that score would be through the roof compared to my dumb mile repeats where I burned really hot and fast and got it done. Yet I'd be way more wrecked after those VO2 max intervals than I would be after my threshold long run. But on paper, that never commutes to like the heart rate data, the time spent in zones. So that's where the one thing where I'm like, why am I so fatigued? My relative effort in my Strava score is going down as I'm trying to peak when I should be getting the most fit. And that's where I think you can't account for like the nervous system. I think that's the missing link.
Yeah, it is. And so to go back to all the beginning of this, VO2 max work, if you're getting the most you can out of the workout, the last 20% of the workout, you're digging like that. Like, you're mentally steeling yourself before each rep. Like, all right, bear down, you don't even want to start, but you've got to hit this. And then halfway through the rep, you're fighting to keep your form together and you're working hard and you're digging deep. It's that digging part that is the real trauma during the workout. Yeah, yeah, cardiovascularly, systemically, there are repercussions, but it's that the last bit of it that really digs your grave.
So what would you do then? Like, I have one other question I want to pose.
Yeah.
I'm going to get tangential again, but let's say you have a 5K or a 10K or even a half marathon where you could warrant some VO2 max work. No problem. A marathon even. I mean, it's warranted. And let's say you decided to do that. I'm going to make a big push. I'm 6 weeks out. I'm going to cycle some VO2 max set, whatever your justification is. Mm-hmm. What would you do in that? Let's say you go 3 weeks. Then what do you do in week four?
Well, my theories on all these have changed a lot in the last few years. I probably answered this question on this podcast before, but it's different now. Early on, I would accumulate the maximum volume I could in that quote unquote VO2 max range, even if that meant 200 meter reps. I would just try to get volume in. And then as we got closer, I would do a few more efforts where I did significantly less reps and went longer. I don't think I'd try to build as many like 5x mile workouts or 3x mile. I'd do a lot of like 20x200 or 15 or 12x400. And then I'd have one where I went mile 8-6 at significantly faster than race pace to like balance the two out. Because what I've just come more and more to grips with is that volume of intervals are very, very powerful, and that you need less taste than you think of the really nasty stuff. So I would probably do something like 1,000 at mile pace, 10 minute recovery, 4x4. That'd be a big workout, but not huge volume. And then the next day I'd go back, or the next workout, go back to like 20x200.
I think I would push off my first quality session of the week by a day or two. I'd push it back. If I normally do it on Tuesday, I do it on Wednesday or Thursday, and I mix distance or efforts. Maybe I even start in threshold and then cut down or do some sort of pyramid with maybe not a ton of rhyme or reason, but it's touching on systems. And then I would just do an easy long run over the week, and I'd like take a hard reset. I'd push it back, let me recover, and then not a quality long run. I'd probably just take like a harder reset, I think. But what you're explaining would make a lot of sense too.
What we did in college that got us fit and I think gave us very little staying power was that we just spammed classic 800 meter workouts, a lot of twos, threes, and fours. And the twos we ran either too hard or too many of them or not enough rest. And the fours we did too infrequently, and only preseason did we go above that. I think what I would do if I had to do it again is I'd split them into more skill and like staying power workouts. I'd be running 150s or twos, but I would give myself more rest and really work on the skill of being that fast and smooth. And I would work a lot of longer VO2 max intervals, like threes, fives, sixes, 700s, 900, like those in between distances, like you said, that are difficult. I would try to get better at those, but significantly less reps of those throughout the workout. I don't think we'd need as many as we did, because we always ended up running them too hard.
You'd work like both ends of the spectrum more and less in the middle.
We did a lot of it in the middle. Yeah. And since you're always going to run too hard in VO2 max workouts, almost always, like the middle is the most dangerous. If it's long enough, you can convince yourself that this is a long rep, build into it. And if it's short with a lot of rest, like who cares? You overworked. It was 150 meters. Get over it. You're fine. But that middle ground, I think, is the most dangerous ground.
Yeah, we didn't do a lot of that. I mean, we'd be a 1500 meter runner and we would run like 1100 meter repeats. Is one of our coaches' favorite, where you come through 800 at 215 and then you kick home 300 in 40, whatever the prescription was. Let's say 49 or whatever, and then you take your rest and you repeat. Or we'd be doing 4x6x200 with 30 seconds rest on the other end.
Yeah,
but we didn't do much in the middle, and I think I liked that. The question I wanted to ask you, and maybe I'm out of my gourd here by asking this, but I often think about this with strength training. Like, what is the lactate threshold version of strength training, and what is the VO2 max version of strength training? Do you get what I'm asking? Of course, the systems and energy systems are completely different, but like, what is the foundation to my strength, and what is what's going to build the explosive power? Like, what rep scheme would be because we always preach threshold, right? Well, I believe there should be a version of that for strength training. Like, what is my go back? What do I go back to relay foundation?
See this little satisfied smirk I have here?
I do. Why are you smirking like that?
Because I was spending a lot of time thinking about this for Hyrox and hybrid training.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Rich and I had a call last week and talked for like 90 minutes about this topic, which is, I think muscular endurance is the threshold.
100%
strength training. But I think muscular endurance workouts are too much most of the time. My example is German volume training. This is what I've been talking with some people about. German volume training, 10 sets of 10 reps done at like 60%+ of your max. That is a massive workout. And the logical part of my brain says, there's no way the body knows we are based off the DECA system, like 10's base system. It doesn't know that. So what are the odds that the perfect muscular endurance stimulus aligns with 10 reps done 10 times? Like 10 is such an arbitrary number, but it's a great number because it aligns with our 10's base system. And so the first article I found was that, again, you have to take into account who is the study testing. And it was, again, like 25-year-old men who are like intermediate to novice-based lifters. But they had someone do German volume training 10 by 10, and then they had the other group do 5 by 10. And they found no discernible difference in muscle recruitment, overall power, or anything by the end of it. But the 5 by 10 group all PR'd by more at the end. Meaning they're probably fried. Fresher. Yeah, they weren't fried. So Seiler talks about, he's like one of the godfathers of polarized training, 95 to 97% of the benefits of lactate threshold training occur at only 90% of lactate threshold.
So why doesn't that apply to strength training in a sense?
It can't be the same number maybe, but there's some of it. And what that study showed is it might occur at 50% of German volume training. You might get 90 some percent of the benefit there. So does that make that the most sustainable place? And so that's what I'm doing with my lifting right now. You'll see GVT on my Strava on my lifting. And I started with 4x10 and I'm up to 6x10 and I'm doing a little bit of 8x8 in there. I'm playing around with what point do I get to feel like this was a threshold workout? I've done good work, but I'm not setting myself back. And one of the hard parts is that muscular endurance training, the benefits come from having to recruit muscle fibers late under fatigue. So like sets 5 through 10 are worth more than 1 through 5, but where is that sweet spot? So anyways, it's interesting that you're bringing that up now because I'm thinking about that currently. And obviously the 3x5 is the VO2 max work of the world, or 5x5 or 4x4.
Or 5x3 or 3x3.
Yeah, that 3 to 5 rep range, or 3 to 5 sets.
It's so funny you say that because the athletes I coach that are listening, they're just like nodding their head. We've never talked about this before, but for what it's worth, listeners, and I'm going to say 7 out of 10 of my hybrid athletes are on a 5x10 program right now.
Okay.
5x10. Because I call it pseudo German volume training. I just put pseudo in there because I think it's sustainable. We sit in that pattern for maybe 8 weeks because German volume training, 8 weeks would be whew. And then maybe a month out from the race, we rip down and we decrease rep counts, generate just a little more power, show up to the race with a bit of endurance layered in there and a little more power. And that's the, so my philosophy, literally, I could have echoed in probably less poetic words exactly what you just said, because that's exactly what I'm prescribing right now. I love us.
Even if we're wrong, I like the way we're thinking about it. So here's my theory. You asked for an actual number, which I'm doing the ChatGPT and giving you a range. Is it 4x10? Is it 6x10? I'm going to give you an actual number. My theory is that quote unquote LT work for German volume training is 7 to 8x8.
Okay,
I think right there, that's the actual. Spot. Yeah. If you think of 70 to 80% of max heart rate is where a lot of people would do their true like threshold based work. And under sub threshold, 70-80%. Let's do 70-80% of German volume training, both in sets and in reps. I think that's key. I don't think you can do 70 of one and 100 of the other. You can, but it's, I think maybe even 6 to 8x8 might be the perfect muscular endurance workout right now in my current place in time.
What about one set of 20?
Okay.
You see in all the rage on one set of 20.
I was just talking about this. Rich and I were talking about this.
Is that your quality long run stimulus there? What is that?
I think it's actually peaking. That's what I think. I think it's peaking. I think you go from 8x8 into 1x20 for the last 3 to 4 weeks leading up to 10 days out from your event. I think that for hybrid could be the way to progress. So you drop your overall volume as you're most likely in those last 3 to 4 weeks, also raising your sled work, your weighted lunges, all of that. You have more available to spend there, but you're getting very event specific and having to dig deep for double digit reps, but you only have to do it once. That's my answer, Kirk.
All right. Well, I think your range of sets is too narrow, because why can somebody do why can somebody hold threshold for 30 to 60 minutes? That's a big range. Why can't it be 4 to 8 sets of 10, depending on the person, for threshold?
Can be.
Yeah.
But then you'd have to go up higher in your percentage of max. Just like 30 minute threshold is different from 60 minute threshold pace. I think you'd do the same thing for lifting.
Yeah, we are so far in the weeds right now. It's okay. Fantastic.
At this point, the casual listeners have either gone out, blocked us, or thrown their phone directly through their wall because they don't care about VO2 max sharpening or what is the threshold of lifting. And then there are like single digit.
We're talking about something that doesn't even exist. The threshold lifting is the dumbest term that could ever be coined. And by the way, I think threshold lifting is 5 sets of 10, but with reduced rest in the 60 to 90 second range. And I think
Don't reduce rest.
VO2 max would be rest in the 2 to 3 minute range, but 3 to 5 reps. That's what I'm going with. I'm changing the rest too.
Okay.
All right. Should we move Should we move on?
There are maybe 8 to 10 people nodding their heads like, yeah, man, preach. And there are so many people that are all
Jeremy Whitley. Yeah. Jeremy, you nodding your head, bro.
He's in on it. If Joshua Reed's listening this week, he's in about this.
Fist bump, bro.
All right. Let's go back to standard questions here.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, guys. I'm so sorry that we did that to you for a second.
Can I train for an ultra marathon by using a marathon training plan and extending the long run? Sweet, simple, logical, will apply to way more people than VO2 max sharpening or this theoretical stroking contest of describing lactate threshold lifting.
That really, like, we should be, there's going to be like actual, let's call it, doctors of physiology out there listening to us and just like banging their head against the desk, just being like, these guys.
We're not applying the term. Just the concept.
I know, but I just have to imagine somebody very well studied. I'll call you well studied and me studied. has to be just rolling around. All right.
I quoted a paper that said 5x10 is just effective and moderately trained athlete is 10x10, and that's science. Boom.
Science. All right. ChatGPT says, well, using a marathon training plan as a foundation and extending the long run can be a reasonable approach to training for ultra marathons. There are some important considerations to keep in mind. Ultra marathons typically involve distances beyond the standard marathon, often ranging from 31 miles.
Not typically, always. Get that right. We found their first mistake of the day.
Okay. And then it gives us, holy smokes, 8 talking points. Here are some tips to adapt a marathon training plan for an ultra marathon. Increase weekly mileage, longer long runs, incorporating back-to-back long runs, terrain-specific training, practice nutrition and hydration, recovery and adaptation, build mental toughness, tapering, and incorporating strength training.
I only count 3 of those, Kirk, as valid.
Well, and I will give it some credit here. Like where it says incorporate strength training, it says include strength training to improve muscular endurance and reduce the risk of injury. Focus on exercises that target the muscles used during trail running and uphill downhill sections. So it's taken into account that all are typically on varied terrain. So like, you're right. Incorporate strength training and it gives us the why, sort of. Build mental toughness. Ultramarathons are mentally demanding. Use your extended long runs to develop mental toughness, practice positive self-talk, and refine your race day mindset. Like, they're valid enough, they explain, but...
Unpopular opinion, marathons are every bit as mentally demanding as ultras are. The last 6 of a marathon cannot be worse than anything I've ever experienced in an ultra. Different, sure. Worse, no.
I think if you're racing a marathon...
Yes.
I don't think there's much difference into the level of suck that you sit in versus racing an ultra. The level of suck you sit in an ultra is slightly dulled but extended, and the level of suck in the marathon is slightly heightened but shortened. And right. I think it all equals out. If you're going to nail each race, that is.
I'm glad they said the term muscular endurance, because if I were to say, can I just do a marathon training block with long runs? I would say yes, but, and we said this with Joshua Reed, yes, but you have to address the muscular endurance.
Yeah.
Full stop. Outside of that, the training plan itself does not need to be different. I disagree. You do not need to consider expanding or raising your volume, because marathon volume is already as high as a person can run. In theory, you're running the biggest volume you can run safely. You're not going to find more of it for an ultra. I would think you might need to reduce it.
I was just going to say that. I bet you if you took the top 50 marathoners in the nation, and then you took the top 50 ultra marathoners in the nation, I bet you the average miles per week for the ultra time on feet, forget miles, just because some are running in the mountains. I bet you the average time on feet is less for the top 50 ultra marathoners in the in the country versus the marathoner. You do?
You had me until you said time on feet. Mileage, 100%.
Well, mileage for sure, but then there's holes you can pick in that.
Time on feet with Vert, I think they have crazy more mileage.
You think?
Yeah. For example, Jim will be out for 3 to 5 hours all the time.
I think ultra marathoners embrace alternative forms of training much more wholeheartedly. And if you took the cross training component and the other stuff, like if you're a road marathoner, if you're not running on the roads, screw that. I'm not ellipticaling for extra volume. I'm not doing this.
True.
I think it could be close. I think there's an argument to be made. That's all I'm saying. We'll have to consult the best 50 in each and see where they're at.
Okay. At least we know our middle ground is that we both agree ultra marathoners will run on average lower mileage than elite marathoners.
Yeah.
But other than that, this is good, solid advice.
Yeah. It's basically telling you to level up on all chords. It's saying yes, but no, is what I'm gathering. Yeah. Okay.
We have time for one more, you think?
We have all the time in the world. We haven't been going very long, have we? I got extra time today because I don't, my afternoon client, I start 1 hour later than normal. So I got time.
Oh,
didn't we only start recording like an hour 10 ago? This new system doesn't tell me.
Yeah, that's the downside. This new system doesn't give a timer at the top, which our old one did.
Yeah.
Just when I figured out how to sync my system up, give me an accurate time display, our time display is gone. I'm going to have to start using a third party app here.
You might. But yes, we have time.
Okay.
We have a lot of time.
This is a short question. I'm going to ask it exactly the way an athlete would ask it first and see if it can do that. And then we can get more specific.
Okay.
Is humidity really the poor man's altitude?
It's the second question in a row I typed up without a single error, Bracken. You should be proud of me.
I like seeing improvement in any walk of life.
Well, it's giving us an answer. It's curating. All right. Let's see what it says. All right. The phrase humidity is the poor man's altitude is a colloquial expression that suggests training in humid conditions can mimic some of the physiological adaptations seen in altitude training, but without the need for specialized equipment or travel to high altitude locations. However, it is essential to understand the nuances and differences between training in humidity and training at high altitude. And then it's going to say, it just gives us two, one altitude training and then two humidity and training. One, altitude training. Training at high altitude where the air contains less oxygen can stimulate adaptations in the body to enhance oxygen utilization. This includes an increase in red blood cell count and improvements in aerobic capacity. Athletes often use altitude training to gain a competitive edge, but it requires specific conditions found at higher elevations. Part two, humidity and training. Exercising in humid conditions can feel challenging due to the reduced efficiency of evaporative cooling, making it harder for the body to dissipate heat. This can lead to increased perceived effort and heart rate during workouts. Humidity does not directly affect oxygen content in the air, unlike high altitude training. Therefore, it doesn't simulate the same physiological adaptations related to oxygen transport and utilization. While both altitude and humidity can pose challenges to athletes, they impact the body in different ways. It's crucial to recognize that training in humidity may enhance cardiovascular and thermoregulatory adaptations, but it won't replicate the specific benefits of altitude training.
Yes. So what does it do? Well, one, it dehydrates you. which your body's compensatory response to that is to work on making more red blood cells. Now, that's really, really watered down science, and there are a lot more steps in there, but it's why people do sauna post-workout. Dehydrate yourselves, put your body into overdrive. You can generate more, a higher red blood cell count by doing that, which is also your body's natural response to altitude. Is we are starved for oxygen. We need to control what we can control, which is up the transport system. Transport system, red blood cells will make more of that, and then hopefully that'll help us. So you can get a percentage of the same benefit there. What you can't do, no matter what you do at sea level, is reduce the percentage of oxygen in the air, which is really what you're doing at altitude. You take a full lung full of air, and a full lung full of air enters. It just has a lower percentage of oxygen. When you're at sea level, all you can do is restrict the size of what you pull in. So you can make it harder to pull in a full lungful, or make it so you don't take in a full lungful. But that's like strength training your lungs rather than chemically adapting what's happening in your system. So you don't get the red blood cell benefit from that. And I think that's important to know. That's why I like breathing through a straw or a funnel or a, what else do people use? A snorkel or that elevation mask. It doesn't work. It's not a one-to-one to altitude because you can't change the actual percentage of oxygen prevalence in the air.
Humidity is not a poor man's altitude.
It is.
I've trained through that. I have
from
trained
a red blood cell count, Bert. Only red blood cell count. And from a heart rate response. Those two things only.
I'm speaking anecdotally from personal experience. I have trained in the humidity. I mean, I train in the middle of the day a lot of times with my work schedule. And I've trained in the shittiest, humid, hot conditions in the middle of the Minnesota and Wisconsin summers. And then I go to Utah and it's 25 degrees cooler and I feel like death. And most of my runs are done out there in those exact conditions. And it, for me, not a chance. Don't even pretend. The only thing running in humid and heat does for you is make you feel like shit while you're out there. And then when you go to altitude and you feel like shit, you're like, I'm used to feeling like shit because the conditions suck at home. So there's a governor on me, and now there's a governor on me at altitude. So simulating a feeling in which you don't feel your best, which I find value in, sure. But you could tell anybody who runs in the Midwest summers and then goes run a cool mountain altitude race that it translates. And I'll tell you, they're full of crap.
Okay.
That's my opinion.
I'm going to amend my previous statement.
Oh, tail between your legs?
No. Clarification of what I'm referring to.
Okay.
If you train all year round in humidity and you go out to altitude, will you feel any better? No. You will not. It will feel like you have never been to altitude before. If you train in a humid environment versus a non-humid environment, you will feel equally crappy at altitude. Absolutely, at race effort. What the difference is going to be is you will perform better while feeling equally crappy. So if you are in the humidity and I am in an arid climate and we both go to race, you and we're the exact same ability and the same training volume, you're probably going to beat me. All things else equal, but you're going to feel just as crappy as I'm going to feel. The difference is you will actually have a red blood cell count advantage, and you will have a better read on what your heart rate zones are at altitude, having trained in humidity, because they're not one-to-one, but they both elevate your heart rate with at the same perceived effort. So that is the advantage, but you will still feel like death and you won't feel like it's doing anything for you. And if anything, you're going to be more mad on course because you're going to say, everyone told me this is the poor man's altitude training. And it's not, because I still feel terrible. That's my statement.
I stand behind my man on that statement. I just think it has as much to do with how you feel during training, feeling compromised during training, because it's humid and hot and your heart rate gets up too quick. And then you've got a governor on yourself because you're going to tip over if you don't. And then that happens at altitude as well. And it's only exposed more when there's verts involved. And so it's the perfect storm for you Midwesterners going from like summer humid to like dry, cooler altitude. It's like, well, you don't have mountains where you live and train, and you don't have altitude where you live and train. And humidity just doesn't make up for all those factors.
No, I've lived at altitude for almost 3 years, and I have lived in a humid environment the rest of my life. And I've raced at altitude, having done both things, and it is night and day difference. However, I've had a few semi-equivalent performances at short races, never even close at long races.
That's interesting because I think I'd only have a chance at long races at altitude where I can keep a lower percentage of my max. But I don't know. I
think if I were never run a short race at group, altitude. Yes.
Yeah.
But my long races were against people significantly better than me.
Yeah.
So I didn't have a chance. If I could sit against like people like myself and try to dull it, hang on for a while, hang on and then race, sure. But there was no hanging on. I was fighting tooth and nail to not die, to stay on the back of the pack. So that was the big difference for me.
Yeah, I could see that. It's like an altitude mountain sprint. Sounds terrifying, but if you tell me a beast, like, okay, well, I can probably be sort of comfortable for a little while. Well, I think like 30 minutes into a sprint, I'd be already like, yep, I'm going to be tough. I'm going to be a tough 45 minutes here.
I ran the Fort Carson Spartan Sprint living in Wisconsin and fared fairly well.
Never again.
No.
Okay. Do we have more?
Oh, we can have more. I just got all caught up in you disagreeing with me that I didn't know how to respond.
I wouldn't disagree with you.
Kind of. In fact, I even think you said, no way, I'm not buying it. I disagree.
Well, I have a couple of questions too I could throw in here as well.
Oh, this is something we haven't got to, but this is an interesting aside here. Hey, I'm listening to the latest Training Tuesday episode, and I just wanted to let you know Patagonia has a repair center, and if you send in your jacket with the broken zipper, it will get fixed for free! Exclamation point.
It's still sitting here. I don't even touch that jacket with that broken zipper. I got to do that.
Game changer.
It broke like 2 weeks in. All my other Patagonias, I put through the ringer. I have beat them to crap. I have four others. Not one problem with any of them other than a few holes I ripped in because of barbed wire, right? Like, that's not their fault. It's mine. And then this one, 2 weeks in, zipper breaks. Good to know. Thanks, man. Or gal. Or it. Did ChatGPT send you that?
Chelsea.
Chelsea. Thanks, Chelsea. All
right, this is an interesting handle. I generally don't put people's names out there, but this interests me. Bat Country Goes for Miles.
Bat Country?
Yeah, and then there is what appears to be a bat emoji next to it.
Probably an ultramarathoning reference.
Interesting.
Chime in, Chelsea. Chelsea chimes in with what that it means. All right, can I ask one?
Oh, please do.
An athlete I coach, Robert Landman, also a dentist, also gets up at like 3:30, and I see his workout start times at like 3:59 a.m. or like 4:01 a.m. Mm-hmm. You know, he works that full job. He gets up that early. Dude, I don't know when he sleeps, but I've seen pre-4 a.m. start times in the parking ramp so he can get vert up and down the parking ramp in the big city. Anyways, going back to your episode.
Before you even start, I'm going to go off in the weeds. I read a thread on what is the... one of those Reddit threads, what is the most blank that you blank? So this was, what is the flex that is not the flex people think it is? And the most common answer was bragging about how little sleep people get. Like, that's not impressive. That's a sign of a bad life or mental illness or like that you're going to be at a reduced capacity. And I agree with that. However, people who get up early for workouts is still something that impresses me to no end. Mm-hmm. People who are like, my only window is 3:30 a.m. and I did it. It just instant respect for that person.
And he's never once bragged to me about it. I just see it. He doesn't use that. That is not a thing he dangles around or shoves in anybody's face. Robert just does it. Sometimes they say things and they don't register in the moment. No dangling things in people's faces, Robert. All right.
Fishing analogy.
That was a fishing analogy. I know you have said, this is an email he sent to me, and this is a brief part of that email. I know you have said for a long effort, shorter warm-ups are necessary or allowed, right? Mm-hmm. And for short bursts, longer warm-ups would be indicated. For DecaFit, what is a reasonable amount of pre-race run?
Ooh.
As well as how much station work should be done as a warm-up? You know? How good is, do you think ChatGPT can understand this?
I think we have to leave Deca out in the first try.
Okay.
Is it true you warm up longer for shorter running races?
How much running should I do as a warm-up before DecaFit? I'm going with it.
Okay.
I'm going all in. It knows it. So you didn't have faith, and I did. Does that mean DecaFit's made it if ChatGPT recognizes it? It
means Yancey's done his job.
Attaboy, Yancey. The amount of running you should do as a warm-up before DecaFit can vary based on your fitness level, blah, blah, blah. DecaFit is a fitness concept created by Spartan, combining functional fitness and running elements. Here are some general guidelines for a warm-up. Dynamic warm-up. running warm-up. It says, depending on the DecaFit format, like of your choosing, a short run, approximately 5 to 10 minutes at an easy pace. That's what it says. And then incorporate sports-specific movements, dynamic stretching, and a gradual progression. Gradually increase the intensity of your warm-up to match the expected intensity of the DecaFit workout. This will allow your body to transition smoothly from rest to exercise. All right, I'm convinced ChatGPT has been listening to us.
That's it. There it is. Because we invented warm-ups. All right, it's good. So I'm not even going to bother trying to fix that. That's great. I would do some transition work before a DECA. But to answer that, we have said something very similar to the longer the race, the less you can get away with warming up, and the shorter the race, the more you have to warm up. But I actually don't mean that specifically to warming up. I mean it to the amount of running you do before the race.
And I think the amount of intensity.
And intensity, yes. So before my last ultra, I probably warmed up for 35 minutes, but probably 5 minutes of it was any sort of something that could be considered close to running. But I went through the entire systems checklist of getting my body mobile, stretching through even more actual, like more dynamic stretch, not like static stretching, but making sure that I went through the range of motion I was going to need at any point, because coming in stiff to the first descent of an ultra is a recipe for disaster. Like, you have to get dynamic in some ways, and it's about downhills specifically. Yep. For me, I have to be ready for that. Even if I'm not warming up my heart rate very much, I have to do something that simulates ripping a downhill so that I don't take damage early in an ultra.
I agree with you. I think maybe being more specific with probably spend the same amount of time run or warming up, but the ratio of time on feet in the run specific motion can go down in a longer event.
Yes.
And in a shorter event. Yeah, I agree with you. But I would say for like a computer generated question about a DECA fit, that may be the most impressed answer I've seen so far.
Especially because the body of work to draw from on the internet is just, what, 2 years for DecaFit information? It can't go back and cultivate millions of articles.
Right. And I did skip over some of like the explanations of the dynamic stretching, right?
Yeah.
Like something like dynamic stretching, include dynamic stretches exercises to target major muscle groups. Dynamic stretching helps improve flexibility and range of motion without holding static stretches for extended period. It gets into like, you know, the functional movements of the sport and its descriptors and things like that. So,
yeah. Okay. So all this being said, Kirk, if I only had 2 minutes to prepare for a race, it better be an ultra.
Yeah, I agree with that.
If I only had 5 minutes to prepare for a race, it better be an ultra. 10 minutes, ultra. The less time I have, the longer I want it to be, to the point where I had an athlete where I recommended they warm up their running on the first long extended climb. Said, get yourself ready for the downhills physically beforehand, but we're not even going to raise our heart rate yet. We're going to do that on the first climb because it was like a 3 mile climb at 10% or if alternating between 5 and 10% grade. They're going to be on the thing for nearly an hour before. And this was during like a 36 mile race that they weren't trying to win. We're just going to warm up the first gradual climb. Let everyone blow out too early because that's the perfect grade to go out too hot. But if you tell yourself, here's my warm up, you're not going to go out too hot.
You have plenty of time to warm up in that hour long run up the hill.
Be real
without needing any other skill.
Yeah. And it's going to encourage you to walk around the first hill because that's how you would warm up.
Yeah. All right. I'm happy moving on from that one if you are.
I'm very happy. It's a
good question.
What else you got for me?
Okay. You want me to do this? I'll do this. I'll put the team on my back. All right. I don't know what we want to do. I don't even know if we want to type this one in or it warrants maybe. We'll just see. As we hit the off season, I find myself hitting more strength /hybrid to balance out my longer base miles. Could you do an episode with specifics on how to optimize machines, stroke rates on rower, some good workouts for foundations for a strength off season? So we kind of talked about good workouts or foundations for a strength off season. I would consider that our threshold opinion of strength training we dissected, but on how to optimize machines.
Assuming you're not advanced on machines, I think we approach machine stroke rate like we approach running pace, which is over, under, and on. If you want to target, let's say 26 strokes per minute in a high rocks, let's say that's just what you're going to shoot for. I think you should be doing 16, 26, and 36, something like that. Maybe not those exact numbers, but if you can teach yourself to be semi-efficient and hit the same paces and get some good economy of motion and efficiency going, there's a lot of buzzwords. If you can be smooth and relaxed and transfer power to the machine at extremely low and extremely high stroke rates, you are very, very adaptable on race day, and you're just more resilient. And it teaches you what actually drives power on machines. I was just chatting a little bit about this with Matt Gross, and I've been chatting a little bit about this with some other people, and I've been tweaking it with myself. Again, you go on Strava, you'll see a few of my workouts. I'm doing intervals where interval one for 500 meters, it's extremely low, like 12 to 15 strokes per minute. And then two is right on, and then three is extremely fast, trying to figure out how do I drive power the most efficient means possible at each one of these things. And then eventually at 20, mid 20s per minute, I feel better. So I think that's a really good thing to work on in workouts in the off season, to just get better at the act of using the machines.
I did ask ChatGPT, how do I optimize my stroke rate on the rower? Ooh. And it gave me an answer. Also, sidebar, do you know, I've noticed a trend with some of the athletes, both like pro level and then that I've worked with, not only playing with stroke rate, but then playing with the damper settings, obviously, which most people play around with. Are you noticing a trend towards a lower damper setting as of late?
Yeah.
Because it seems like more and more people, as they get more and more dialed in, are like, you know, seven sort of like the center point for most people. Stick it at seven, see how it feels. I'm finding more and more people in like that five range. Like they're like, I think I'm better off with a lower damper setting. You're finding that too?
Yeah, 100%. And when I first did my first Hyrox, obviously it was first on my first. When I did my first Hyrox, I tried to dive into all the tutorials and read people's writings from the rowing world. And they're all talking about, they spend a lot of time closer to three than closer to eight, mm-hmm. but they save their higher damper settings for hour-based intervals, like less than 30 seconds, 10 seconds or less, they'll be at a 9 or a 10, but rarely touching that. And they do a lot of 1-3 work. And these are like, these are people that are rowing at a rate that we can't even fathom. But it's not useful to a beginner. It's like saying the top Tour de France people are cycling at an extremely high rate. That's exhausting to a beginner. But a beginner can just thrash away against a big gear for a while and get tired and cause stimulus in their body to improve them. And that's how we all were on the ergs. People just started working hard, and now they're starting to tinker and work at a high level, which means easier gears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, anyways, that's a sidebar. I just wanted to bounce that off. It sounds like we're hearing the same thing.
But that's interesting you're noticing that, because
for sure
there's a lot of people tinkering right now. Which you don't tinker until you've become relatively proficient. That's a cool sign.
Yeah. I asked ChatGPT, how do I optimize my stroke rate on the rower? Optimizing your stroke rate on the rower, and you could probably apply this to the ski erg as well, involves, that was my ad, not the ChatGPT, that would be next level, involves finding a balance between power and efficiency. The stroke rate, measured in strokes per minute, plays a crucial role in your overall performance. Here are some tips to help you optimize your stroke rate on the rowing machine. Understand stroke rate and power, you know, understanding the difference. Start with a warm up. Focus on technique. Okay, these are actually not very helpful. And experiment with stroke rates, which you outlined. Monitor split time. So pay attention to your split time on different damper settings or stroke rates. And then interval training, training principles really is what it's giving us now. So it tells you to hire a coach as well. So I don't know. That wasn't very helpful, but at least it understood.
Yeah. And variable stroke rate, I think, is the way to dial it in.
I mean, 12 to 15 is pretty low.
Super low. It's very hard. Like 17 to 18 is comfortably slow for me. Anything under that is obnoxious.
Okay. So this is from another athlete. I'm working with Jared. And this is the last one I've screenshot, although we have a bunch in our Running Public inbox. I know we have too, but I'm curious if ChatGPT will take it this far. I remember one quick thing, unrelated thing, could even be a Q&A for TRP. The best bargains on running gear you've gotten. He's like, I found a new pair of North Face Flight Vective trail shoes for $50 and the Nathan single 20 ounce water bottle and running belt for $3 at Walmart. So he's asking, what are the best bargains on running gears that we've found? Do you think ChatGPT has a chance here?
I think they're going to give you places to find cheap running gear. I don't think it'll give you specific examples, no.
What are some of the best sales on running gear right now? That's what I'm going to ask.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. Patagonia Houdini jacket was one of my best.
It has never taken this long to curate an answer. I think I froze it. Oh, never mind. There it goes. It doesn't give any specific links. I don't have any real-time information on current sales as my training only includes data up to January 2022. Huh. Did you know that? Data only up to 2022. All right. That was not helpful.
In college, I found a pair of Nike Zoom Max Cat spikes at the Nike outlet for $9.99. If I recall correctly, that was like $120 spike. That's a great sale. $9.99.
I will say that I'm starting to find the prices drop on the Nike Alphafly Next Percent. They're coming the original, like the Next Percent, because there's two new models out now, or the new model that the threes are going to be dropped shortly, that now I think people aren't going as far back. So I bought two pair of Nike Alphaflies this last week because I found them cheaper than I have in years. Wow. The one I like, the Next Percent, and I bought them. And one pair I paid like $160 for. And I know that's a lot of money for a pair of shoes, but you're almost paying $300 at times for like the new Alphaflies. And so I ripped two pairs at $165 in my size. And so anybody looking for that, I found that just by simply doing an Alphafly Next Percent search on Google, it pulls up a couple. Have you noticed this? There's a number of websites out there now that like, they must have the best resource or scrounge up all the old model shoes, and you can find them on like a handful, and they're legit websites. I thought I was getting scammed or potentially did my research. There's like 3 to 5 websites out there that can like, get you anything you want. They're like the drug dealer for shoes. Like, you want it, we got it. You may pay for it depending on the size. They will price it out by size. Like, hey, you're 10 and a half. We have
like
more of those.
StockX and things like that.
Yeah, it's actually incredible. You can find almost anything that like, oh, I missed my model of my Saucony Peregrines from 6 years ago. Guess where you can find it? Yeah. These websites. It's bizarre.
And
anyways, that's
you will run into some fakes and replicas on there. But usually with some research, you can get a read on how accurate it is.
Yeah.
And there are some brands I just don't mess with. Hoka, Salomon, those are two of the most often copied brands I found online. Like the Chinese factories love putting out knockoff Hoka and Salomons. You find them for like $39 all over the internet. And they have since day one. My first year in the sport, the Salomon Sense Pro like 2s or 3s were all over online with colors that have never existed. That was like 2012. I was finding those. For whatever reason, Hoka and Salomon are just ripped off everywhere.
But do they actually send you a pair of shoes?
Oh yeah, they'll send you them. They're just knockoffs.
But are they any good?
No, they're terrible.
Like, is it worth buying? Not nothing. They're not worth putting your feet in.
There are two types of knockoffs. They're the knockoffs that go out the side door of the factory. It comes off the line. They just don't put a finishing touch, or they do, or they put nothing on it and just put it out the side door and sell it on knockoff stores. And then they're the kinds that are made somewhere else where they have a prototype in front of them and they just copy it with their materials. And they can make it visually identical or almost identical. But if you can't find the out the side door ones, you can't mess with knockoffs.
What's the most money you have spent on a pair of running shoes, a single pair of running shoes? And what was that running shoe? Not given to you or gifted. You're thinking hard.
I'm looking all around. Probably $189.
That's the most you've spent.
Yeah.
Ugh. How do you have such a shoe fetish and only spend $189 when there's $350 options out there?
I've been fortunate that I've been gifted a decent amount of my shoes or sent the shoes. Like my Alphaflies, I didn't buy. That was probably my most expensive shoe, but I didn't buy that. Or I find them. I'm always searching deals and who has stock of what. And then sometimes, like for a while, I had a decent hookup at Running Warehouse. I was getting 40% off if it was a shoe that was worth having. Little things like that. So I've been fortunate in the shoe area.
Why am I forgetting the brand of shoe
I think people assume I use them enough and talk about shoes obsessively enough that if they sell like three pairs off giving me a shoe, it covers their cost.
Mm. Well, I paid full price for Alphas, and that everybody knows one pair. And that's
that was probably $275 at the time for that one.
Pretty hurtful. Yeah. Painful. Not anymore. The most expensive shoes we own, and I'm blanking on the name right now.
Speedland.
The Speedland with the BOA dials that we were gifted. And I actually really like that shoe. Those are like $350 pair of shoes.
Yeah, those are always three. Like that's that. Ridiculous.
We're very lucky.
I've never run a step in those.
No?
They're too small for me. They're sitting right here, brand new. I use them as a prop shoe to show and talk about carbon fiber plates and how they, but I can't wear them. They're too small for me. And I don't know where to like, it's too long. They're not even made anymore. I can't send them back to the manufacturer. They've just been sitting here for a year and a half.
Really was pleasantly surprised because they're kind of ugly. They're kind of clunky with the BOA dial looking. And then you get in them and I was like, God, it's kind of like an ultra. It's got a little wider toe box for me meets like a high performance shoe. And I don't really consider like an ultra trail shoe a high performance shoe, but it meets like, and so you get in it and it's like got some shoe to it, but I've still felt very efficient. I could run anyways, neither here nor there.
What's the single most expensive piece of fitness equipment you've ever bought? I suppose it's not difficult for us.
Treadmill.
Yeah.
The Nordic treadmill.
Yeah. Which I got mine as a hookup through you.
I used to have a Nordic Track hookup. I don't have that hookup anymore. I could maybe message them and be like, hey, could you cut me a deal? I used to be like an ambassador or something for you. But I got, they used to send me all sorts of stuff. It was fantastic. Not anymore.
This last one that I bought through you is now probably 5 years old. I've had one issue. I re-upped the warranty. I have 2 years left of warranty. And it has been the most durable machine I've ever bought now. But by the time this thing is up, I need a new industry hookup. So I've got to start cultivating some friends somewhere.
I'll see what I can do. Well, just hold, you will have to hold your breath on that.
Speaking of which, everyone should check out the new Wahoo treadmill that's coming out.
Tell more.
It can go side to side up to 1.5% to just give you some side of the road feel or side of the trail feel. But it also has this, intuitive sensor. It has a sensor at the bottom of the console that would look like, as the reviewer said, DC Rainmaker did a review on it. He said, you're junk. It's aimed at your crotch line. And if you run in the middle of the treadmill, it holds its speed. But if you turn on intuitive speed, if you move forward, it matches it with acceleration. So you can hands-free control acceleration. If you move back, it slows down. And he took it from 430 pace to walking in 4 seconds, just so moving backward. He said, I have to get used to trusting it, but I haven't gone off the back yet. And if you move forward, the closer you get, the more it accelerates. So if you want to go from 8 minute pace to 4:30, you can be there in a few seconds. So like starting intervals, you can just be jogging and then just lean into the interval and go. So it has it's got some potential. Now it's going to be a $5,000 machine. But for people who care enough about interval work to want to roll into it enough to buy a new treadmill, they probably don't care about $5,000.
And I thought I was impressed with ChatGPT.
I mean, this technology. Pretty soon it's going to
control everything. I had a couple of conversations in the last couple of weeks about, like, I have a 5K time trial and it's awful outside. And my only resort this week is the treadmill if I'm going to do it. And I'm like, I hate the treadmill because you set it and forget it and it controls you. You don't control it. And I do believe that. And so you're never really going to get a snapshot of your fitness. But in this case, if that treadmill could intuitively respond to your effort level, I would maybe start veering closer to trusting that as some sort of benchmark.
And the faster you get, the less you want to move your hand out and do stuff.
You mean to like push buttons and crap?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, I'll look at that. I don't know what I'm going to do when this one goes. The Tough Tread thing is like, it seems to be bulletproof, but they're like very pricey.
Yeah.
But sweet. I don't know. We'll see.
I don't think I'll ever stop getting an incline trainer. I just don't. If anything, I'll have two machines. I'll get a second machine, like an assault runner or something just for flat and fast, but I'll never get rid of the incline function.
We're going to have to come up with more TRP offerings so we can get that going for you.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Should we answer one or two more?
Hey, well, let's do one.
One it is. Do you have any in front of you or do you need me to start scouring our inbox?
I have one.
Okay.
What is the best system of endurance run training?
Ooh, I wonder if it's going to recognize in what context you're asking. What is the best system of endurance run training?
Mm-hmm. It's going to get this right because all it does is hedge its bets, which is the right answer.
Well, it came up with a blank for me that's showing nothing. Oh, which it hasn't done yet. Yeah, nothing's curating. What is the, let's see if it was a glitch. The best system of endurance run training? Question mark. You might have broke the system.
Maybe it's poorly worded.
Oh, there it goes. Must have been a glitch. Oh, traditional base building, periodization, high intensity interval training, fartlek training, tempo runs, polarized training. It's not giving us that, what you're looking for. Progressive overload. That's not what you're asking. I assume that's not what you're asking.
No, but I didn't think it could do something. It was going to give us like, all training styles are great if applied to the athlete correctly. And it's dependent on what athlete history you have.
No, it's interesting about this answer. So it gives you 10 bullet points, right? Okay, just this one is so, it's like somebody must have paid them to insert this in here. Whoever, maybe ChatGPT has a bank account. It goes traditional base building, periodization, high intensity interval training, fartlek training, tempo runs, polarized training. And number 7, Yasso 800s.
It probably appears more than any other workout online, and they just chose it as a system.
Named after Bart Yasso, this workout involves running 800 meter repeats at a pace equivalent to your goal marathon time. It's a specific workout that can help gauge fitness and predict marathon performance. And then from Yasso 800s, it goes run-walk method, progressive overload, and specificity training. But Yasso must have paid these guys off.
Okay, so let's run this. Let's take this and run with it, Kirk. Yasso 800. So the concept is you run an 800 meters, and the time it takes you is your goal marathon time. So your three-hour goal marathon, you run a three-minute 800. And then you rest, what is it, 90 seconds rest?
I don't know, but I just asked, what are Yasso 800s? So let's see.
It's either 90 or 2 minutes, I thought.
No, it says four-minute recovery jog.
That seems dumb.
Yeah, start with a warm-up, then run 800 meters at a pace that corresponds to your goal marathon time. For example, if you aim to run a four-hour marathon, your target pace for each 800 meter interval would be 4 minutes. After completing the 800 meters, take an equal amount of time to jog or walk for recovery.
Rest to work.
Repeat the process for a predetermined number of repetitions. Beginners might start with 4 to 6 reps, while more advanced runners could do 10 or more. So maybe you could do 10 reps of 800 meters with 4 minute with equal recovery, and your average 800 meter could be a rough guesstimation of your goal marathon.
10 reps, says you have to hit to be able to say that that's a good representation. Well,
it says more advanced, but what it's saying is the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. So so I think what you're saying is if you run it in 230, you would take a 230 jog recovery. So right, I think it's equal recovery.
And what do we know about equal rest recovery? That's generally reserved for VO2 max work.
Yeah.
Or faster. So if we off the top of your head, do you know what 3 hour marathon pace is?
It's probably like 6:55.
Well, 6:52.
6:52?
Yeah. So 6:52 pace is your marathon pace, which makes, in theory, 6 minute pace is like your tick over 5K. So what we said, rest to work ratio is correct. VO2 max interval. So 5K pace are a little faster, which is not true VO2 max. True VO2 max is 6 to 9 minutes of work. So for most people, this is more than double their VO2 max. But anyway, we're getting into the weeds here. 5K pace 800s with equal work to rest as a predictor times 8 to 10 for marathon finish time. I think it's a horrific, horrific predictor, but what it tells you is, are you in shape enough to run well?
Well, now I'm curious. I think 10 should be the benchmark. And I'm wondering if I went out and said, I'm going to run 225 per 800 and give me 225 walk recovery, could I hold on to that for 10 rounds? Like, for some reason, that's an itch I kind of want to scratch. Whether it's good or not, I'll have a good workout and move the needle. I can't decide how it would translate as a predictor.
I think it certainly is more accurate for endurance-based runners rather than speed-based runners.
Yeah.
Because I've done this workout back. I did this back in Lake Geneva when I was in just post-college. I was teaching at Bigfoot, but living at Lisa's parents' house because they lived close to the school I was teaching at. So for half a year, I lived at her house. her parents' house. And I, on the Lake Geneva middle school and high school track, I did Yasso 800 to test it out when I'd first heard about it. And I think I did 230s just to do that. I was coming off college running. 230s were what? That would be 40 seconds. 230s would be 5 minute pace, which would be 45 seconds per mile slower than mile pace for me. So it was certainly slower than 5K pace. But anyways, to put it in context, it was not challenging. I ended up cutting out the rest halfway through because I wanted a better workout. And in no world could I run a 230 marathon or even close. So a strength-based runner would be a better predictor. But basically, it's saying, how is your endurance?
Yeah. But I still think 10 reps. I think you want to err on the side of more reps than it says 4 to 6 for beginners, 100%. But then that's going to translate less. I think you got to go the full 10 rounds of 800 meters with equal rest.
I don't think it tells you, can I run a 3 hour marathon? It says you can't run faster than that. Like if you can run 6 minute pace with equal rest, you can't break 6 minutes or 3 hours in a marathon. I think that would be more of what I would say, but I would never choose that as my marathon predictor, but it's just a thing that exists and people love it. And it's easy to understand. And it's a number that has no scientific sense, but it's logical from a number standpoint. So people love it.
All right. I totally took this sideways and asked ChatGPT while you were talking, what US run training group is the best?
Oh,
It says determining the best can be subjective and depends on individual preferences, da, da, da. But it still had to list them in order from 1 to 8. It gave us their, let's say, opinion. I want to
only up to January 2022, which is key.
Well, I don't know if that was in regards to, I don't know if that's in regards to shopping or if that's in regards to all data. That I don't know.
So is Bowerman number one?
So there's 8 of them listed. You will recognize all of them, I think. So number one, Bowerman is number 2.
Do they still have Nike Oregon Project as one?
Nike Oregon Project is 1.
Okay.
Coached by Alberto Salazar prior
so to, this is old data.
No, then it says prior to its disbandment.
Oh, okay.
NOP was known for producing elite distance runners. Okay. Number 2, Bowerman Track Club. Number 3, take a guess.
I'm going to say Hoka Arizona. NAZ Elite.
That's number 5. Okay. Hanson's Brooks Distance Project, number 3. Number 4, Mammoth Track Club. Number 5, NAZ Elite. Number 6, Atlanta Track Club Elite. Number 7, Brooks Beast Track Club. Beast. And number 8, NorCal Distance Project. That's what it says. Anyways, I don't know why I got curious about that, but I just... Should I ask who is Bracken Crocker?
Oh, please do.
All right. We're off the rails, but we're capping this thing up. So let's just see.
Searching. What gives us. Searching. Searching.
Who is Bracken Crocker? All right. Should I read the whole thing?
Yeah.
I'll do it for... Okay. It gave me 3 paragraphs. As of my last knowledge update in January 2022. So I guess that is the most recent update on ChatGPT, which seems like a long time ago considering technology, right?
Yeah.
Are you on the edge of your seat? I want to look at your face for a second because I can't see you right now. Oh, he's blushing, folks.
There's no blushing. I'm flush with anticipation.
As of my last knowledge update in January 2022, Bracken Crocker is an American athlete known for his involvement in the sport of obstacle course racing. OCR involves running combined with various physical challenges, blah, 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 blah. Bracken Crocker has been a prominent figure in the OCR community and has competed in various events, including those organized by Spartan Race, one of the leading OCR series. He has often been associated with the Spartan brand and has been known for his competitive performances. It's important to note that information about individuals, especially athletes, can change, and there may be have been developments in Bracken Crocker's career or life since my last update. For the latest and most accurate information, I recommend checking official OCR websites, Bracken Crocker's social media profiles, and other reliable sources.
Wow.
Do you feel like that was, you were underserved a little bit there? I do.
I was overserved. They called me an athlete.
So what do you think it's going to lead with for me? And then we're going to stop this nonsense.
It'll have personal training, but it's going to have a lot of Bachelor in Paradise stuff. Hope it says something about how he's a killer of animals, an enemy of PETA, and a reality TV.
There is nothing about me being an athlete. As of my last knowledge, Kirk DeWitt is an American reality television personality who gained prominence through his appearances on the ABC reality dating show The Bachelorette. He first appeared on season 6 of The Bachelorette, which aired in 2010, competing for the affections of Ali Fedotowsky. Kirk made it to the final four contestants before being eliminated. Following his initial appearance on The Bachelorette, Kirk DeWitt returned to the Bachelor franchise for Bachelor Pad Season 2, which aired in 2011, and this spinoff, blah, 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 and then it goes on about, it's just Bachelor-related stuff. And none of it said at the running public. What are we doing wrong?
Well, 2022, I don't know.
One last one. I'm on a tear. What is the podcast, The Running Public? Do you think we could ask that?
Yes. What is The Running Public? I wouldn't even say podcast.
Do I have to put things in parentheses?
No, just capitalize it.
What is
we deserve capitalization.
All right. Sorry, listeners. I'm sure you don't give a crap, but you're here and you're stuck. So what is The Running Public?
What's the implication?
Yeah. Oh, The Running Public is a podcast created by OCR athletes Kirk DeWitt and Bracken Crocker. Both Kirk DeWitt and Bracken Crocker are known for their involvement and achievements in the OCR community. The Running Public podcast focuses on various aspects of running, fitness, and obstacle course racing. The hosts discuss training tips, strategies, and share their experiences with the world of endurance sports. They often feature interviews with other athletes, coaches, and experts in the field.
None of that is verbiage taken directly from our website.
No, none of it.
Yeah. We don't have that on there. Sweet.
All right. Well, we did it, I guess.
So, sort of. Results, we still have a job tentatively, but only if you want the personal touch and rabbit holes.
A lot of tangential conversations. I would say I was more impressed than less, to be honest. It would give people enough knowledge to then search some of the suggestions more deeply and come up with a plan potentially on their own. I think a curious mind would see what it says, be like, okay, I get it, but, and then start going down rabbit holes of their own to get specific answers. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm going to give it a yellow to green light. I think it wasn't bad.
I'm going to give it a light green. It's not full on bright green, but it's green for me. Mm-hmm. Those were all that it started the way we start every one of our answers. It just missed the final personal touch. That's all it's missing.
And it literally said at the end of everything, guys, to hire a coach. So green light, I guess, for me. Now that I think about it,
we're here.
You may want to hire a coach. Here we are for you.
This is really why we did this.
This is a long way to get to that. Okay. All right. I got nothing else other than I don't think we paid this the service, but in our last interview last week, we had 400 episodes, which is a milestone for us. So Bracken, it's been a pleasure. 400 episodes together. The amount of hours we've talked to each other has to be unbelievable. So 400 episodes. That's crazy. 401 today, 402.
402. So one bit of math for you, Kirk. If our training Tuesdays average an hour and our interviews average two, mm-hmm. 90 minutes per episode, 400 episodes. Does that mean mm-hmm. 600 hours we've talked with each other?
Roughly, yeah.
What's the split? If we give of the 600, let's say 200 has been our guests talking. It gives us 400 left. What is the breakdown of hours that you spent talking versus I spent talking of the 400?
I think it's grown closer over the years. To be honest, I think that it's probably not as far apart as people think. An hour 50 to 210, probably. That's what I think. What do you think?
I was going to say 230, 130. And I'm not proud of it.
That'd be
so damn excitable.
That'd be 230, 170, Bracken. But bless your heart.
No, 2.5, 1.5 is what I was saying.
Oh, you're saying 2.5.
2 hours and 30 minutes, 1 hour and 30 minutes. But we were talking hundreds. So 2.5 hours, 1.5 hours.
No. Now I'm confused. Let's not dive too deep into our...
Can I start over? A 400 hours, 250, 150 is what it feels like to me.
I thought you meant...
I don't like it.
I thought you meant 230 and then I
did. It was bad. I didn't mean it, but I said that.
Okay. So who's the idiot here?
Yep.
All right. We're done. Thank you, guys. Hopefully we accompanied on your long run and you enjoying the warmer weather across the country, not freezing your butts off. And we'll see you next week.
Peace.
If anything resonated with you on today's episode and you're curious about taking your training to the next level, check out therunningpublic.com, where we have a training plan to fit your needs.